Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Award-winning Chico author Rob Davidson has been nominated for the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his most recent work, Spectators, Flash Fictions. That's later in the hour. I'll be asking him to read some of his short fictions from Spectators. In 2012, I spoke to Professor Davidson about his then newly released collection of short stories, The Farther Shore. So first, let's listen back to that interview. My guest today is a short story writer and musician. Rob Davidson was born in Duluth, Minnesota, attended Beloit College and Purdue University. From 1990 to 1992, he served in the U.S. Peace Corps in the Eastern Caribbean, where he taught high school English language and literature. He is the author of two collections of short stories, Field Observations, and now a second collection, The Farther Shore. He currently teaches creative writing and American literature at California State University, Chico. Rob Davidson, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And people might wonder, did she say musician?
Yes, you did. More of an informal side venture on my part, really.
Do you compose your own pieces?
I do. I write my own songs and perform them infrequently these days. But I used to be, in a band and all that kind of stuff.
Do you accompany yourself on a guitar or?
Yeah, I play guitar and sing. And I do mostly solo stuff. I had a singing partner here in town for a little while, but I haven't been playing live now probably for about 6 months. So I'm a little out of practice. My fingers are stiff.
Well, when I read the first story in your collection, the character telling this story is telling it in the first person, and he's a musician, and he has a theory of musical relativity. And when I was reading about his theory of musical relativity, I was thinking, I wonder if that's Rob's theory of musical relativity. Rob, why don't you read us a little bit about this character in your first story?
Sure. The title of the story, First Position, is about a struggling musician in the city of Minneapolis. So one day,
which you know because you grew up in Minnesota.
Yeah, grew up in Minnesota, lived in Minneapolis for several years with my wife before coming west. So it's a town I know and love, and your listeners might know a great music scene in Minneapolis, especially in the 80s and 90s when I lived there. Prince would be the name that most people would think of, but The Replacements, Soul Asylum, Run Westy Run. There were some great bands, Husker Du. So if you're into the kind of music that I was into, the rock and roll, it was a great place to be. And, you thought you had an in because there was so much going on, right? But it turned out I was probably better off as a writer than as a musician when it comes to my career plan.
Well, what is your character then? He has this theory.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I'll just read a short passage from the story, and then we can talk about it. On the bus back to Uptown, I explain my theory of musical relativity. Every conceivable human emotion has been expressed in a song. All you have to do is search hard enough, and you'll find it, that voice for what you feel. So everybody should just do covers? Is that what you're saying? Not at all. You have to write your own stuff, the particular embodying the universal and all of that. Look at Joni Mitchell. I don't listen to her, Roz says. She's studying the passengers on the bus. You talk a lot about other people's music. What are your songs like? My stuff? I lean back, looking out the window over my shoulder. Sort of new folk meets cowpunk. It's all acoustic, singer-songwriter stuff. Will you play me some? Yeah, okay, maybe, I say, shifting my haunches. What, don't you have any songs? I got songs, I say hastily. It's just, I haven't been playing out much recently. Fingers are a little stiff, you know? Roz gives me a quick, gentle smile. I've never felt more transparent. Well, I want to hear you. She leans forward and brushes the bangs from my eyes. The boy with the briar patch hair, she says, with a little laugh.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and he's reading from one of his short stories in his collection, The Farther Shore. So you draw on your own experiences as a musician in this story.
As a failed musician. Yeah.
And what was it that appealed to you about this character?
Well, I liked his honesty, with himself. He realizes that he's got ambitions, but he's afraid. He's not ready to really own whatever it is you have to own when you commit to an artistic practice and move from just sort of dreaming and privately thinking about things to actually, you know, putting it out there. And the woman that he meets, Roz, is his catalyst. And he needs, basically, he needs an audience. He needs someone for whom to perform. And so in the story, she inspires him to write a song different from any other song. The songs he's been writing are like songs about recycling, songs about falling in love with dinosaurs, and just kind of weird stuff that maybe you write when you're not ready to write something a little more sincere, a little more heartfelt. And she inspires him to actually start writing a different kind of song, which of course is a hopefully a metaphorical idea about becoming a different kind of artist.
Well, so this is the only story, though, about a musician. So this facet of your life that you draw on, those experiences. A lot of the stories, the person who is the main character is a professor of English or working on a doctorate. So all this is familiar territory, not just for you, but for those of us who live in an academic community. So I enjoyed the aspect of your stories when you would talk about Chico and Bidwell Park and the Sacramento Valley. So those of us who live here can just see very clearly these scenes that you're describing. So you have these stories about people who sometimes it's told in the first person, sometimes it's told in the third person. And I noticed that, and I'm sure you must be aware of it, but that two of your short stories begin in a similar way. And you have this, a lot of the stories about husbands and wives. And one opening sentence struck me. This story was called Party Lines. Anne stood before the bathroom mirror trying to do something with her hair when the screaming started.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great opening sentence.
Oh, good.
When the screaming started. And of course, we find out then that their four-year-old that is screaming.
Yeah.
And then you have another story where the wife is standing in front of the mirror. Peterson paced in the front hallway as his wife primped and preened before the mirror. And then you go on to describe what the wife looks like. And she's taking an awful lot of, paying a lot of attention to how she looks when she's just taking a course. And so he begins to wonder about this.
Yeah. For whom is she getting ready to present?
Yeah. Why does she want to look like $1 million?
Right.
And he says that to her. She said, you look like $1 million. And she replies, do I look like I want to make $1 million? Not that an English professor knows about making money, she smiled facetiously.
Yeah, they're in the beginning of that story, Tell Me Where You Are, the obviously the marriage is on sort of a rocky footing and they're taking jabs at each other. But yeah, it's interesting, you're right. Both of those stories start with someone looking in the mirror. And actually, this is it is something that I'm aware of in my writing. It's actually a carryover from my first book, Field Observations. You know, when I write a collection of stories, I'm often looking for what I call governing metaphors, ideas, images, themes that carry over from story to story and ultimately, you know, hopefully unify the book and make it an actual collection of stories that speak to one another as opposed to just sort of here's the last 10 stories I wrote.
Yeah.
And in Field Observations, at a certain point, I realized that I was writing stories about the ways that we look at each other and read each other, as it were. And that's also a theme that I think pops up in a lot of these stories. So characters are, as we do, is just sort of human nature. We study people. You know, you have an attentive eye. You watch people. And we dress a certain way because we want to send a message. And sometimes that message is received differently depending on who's looking at you. But I've always been interested in that, the ways we look at each other, why we look at each other, and what it is that we actually see when we see someone.
So people who have read your first collection, Field Observations, might recognize that kind of echo.
I would hope so. Yeah, those happy few who read Field Observations.
We might mention, too, that this the character that she's the husband in this story is an English professor. He's up for tenure.
That's right.
And so he's got that stress as if he didn't need this from his wife. And she is an MBA student. And so this is why she's saying, well, you know, dear, you don't know about making money. You're an English professor in so many words. But she is majoring in business. So she has her feet on the ground.
Yeah, from a certain point of view, right? No, anyone who goes into the humanities is has to, you know, be ready for a bit of self-abasement in terms of the salary.
Well, and this couple also started out in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And they moved to Chico.
Right.
And then they're wondering, well, gosh, maybe if I don't get tenure, Mississippi may be next.
Yeah. Or Texas, God forbid.
Yeah, oh, even worse.
Yeah. Right. No, obviously, it's my first campus story, it is a topic I know well. You know, the pressures that a new faculty member is under when you arrive on a campus and are facing this, you know, it seems like whatever, 6 years is a long time before they make a tenure decision. But of course, your whole career rests on that decision. So the pressures are intense. And as I'm sure your readers know, for people, especially in the English department, there's to some degree, there's a pressure to, they say, publish or perish.
Oh, yeah.
And this Peterson, the character in that story, is unfortunately, he's not producing. So he faces the very real threat that he's not going to get.
He's going to be up and out.
Yeah. And that became a, again, for me in my mind, a kind of metaphorical platform that I could build a story around. A marriage is, in a certain sense, not unlike an academic career, in the sense that you commit to something for a long time. You give it a really good hard go. But sometimes you get to a point where a decision is made. And obviously in our culture these days, marriages don't last that long, but there's something about that commitment and that pressure you're under when you're in a committed relationship to sort of see if you can make it work, even if you have to get desperate at a certain point.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and his collection of short stories, he has 8 short stories in this collection and a novella, and the novella won the 2009 Kember Press Fiction Award, and the collection is called The Farther Shore. And you were talking about because this is what you know, academia, the world of academics, and specifically English professors. Mm-hmm. There was a story in your collection that you said was for Henry Hughes.
Yeah.
Because your whole book was dedicated to somebody named Peter.
My son.
That's
son.
What I thought. Yeah. And you do thank your wife, because I figure you cannot not thank your wife, even if the book isn't dedicated to her.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you again.
So you thank your wife and your children.
Yes.
In the acknowledgments. The whole book is dedicated to your son, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
But now, Henry Hughes, you dedicated one of your short stories called The Student to Henry Hughes.
Yes. Henry Hughes is a dear friend of mine. He's a poet. He won the Oregon State Book Award, actually, a couple of years ago. He's the poet laureate of Oregon. He teaches at Western Oregon. But he and I were friends in graduate school. And we used to go for these long runs and just talk about things. And he had been a grad student at Purdue earlier in his career when I wasn't there. And the story, the first part of The Student, it's sort of a story in 3 parts. The first part of that story is something that happened that I fictionalized, but it happened to Henry Hughes. And I remember him telling me this story one afternoon. And the minute he was done, I turned to him and I just said, you know, you have to write this down. It's got everything a story needs. And he said, I don't think I'll ever do that. And I went home and I called him just an hour or two later. And I said, okay, well, if you're not going to have, can I have it? And he said, you do whatever you want. So I wrote and extended it, added 2 more parts to it. But yeah, I dedicated it to Henry because I felt like he very much gave me a gift that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I asked the question, because I suspected that whereas some of this information could be drawn from your own experiences, I suspected that that might have been this person named Henry Hughes might have had something like this happen to him.
Something like that happened to him, yes.
Well, for the listener's benefit, this character in your story is a TA. He's a doctoral student who teaches freshman composition.
Right.
And do you teach freshman composition?
I do. I teach a wide range of classes in the Department of English here at Chico State, mostly creative writing, but American Lit, and also some freshman comp here and there. Yeah.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and we're talking about his collection of short stories, The Farther Shore. And the title, The Farther Shore, I found that really interesting because I have my own view of why you happen to choose this. Well, in the very opening of your book, you quote from the Dhammapada.
Right.
And in that quote is, to the farther shore, go beyond this way or that way to the farther shore.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, why you put it in there, because I loved what I came up with.
Oh.
But I may be totally off the mark. So.
Well, probably not. But a little bit of background. I was doing a residency at the Bird Cliff Artist Colony in Woodstock, New York, and I had this wonderful little cottage on the side of a mountain in the Catskills, and I was there for a month just working on the stories that were in this book. And I had brought with me a copy of the Dhammapada, and I was reading it one evening. And the epigraph to the book comes from the final chapter of the Dhammapada, and it's the Buddha's advice to practitioners. And as you read it, he's sort of encouraging a Buddhist practitioner to not to lack the courage to face whatever it is you have to face and to reach for that farther shore. And as soon as I read that, I mean, I just had the proverbial light bulb go off, because as I mentioned earlier, I often look for governing metaphors or connecting themes. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of ideas about what was happening with the book, but when I read that section of the Dhammapada, it all fell into place, and I understood that the book was about boundaries and journeys and having the courage to cross those lines that we cross in life, sometimes by choice, sometimes by circumstance. You may or may not want to cross that line, but you do have to cross the line. And when you do, you don't know what's across the way on that farther shore. So in my mind, every story in this collection touches on that idea in some way.
In fact, I even thought that you could have actually made a novel of this, because you have different characters in it, but it was so, I saw that unifying thread that he could have made a novel of this.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
But then what is the appeal of short stories versus novels for you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I started out writing short stories mostly because the writers who I was most immediately influenced by when I started writing in the 80s, you know, Raymond Carver, and sort of that group, Richard Ford, Tobias Wolff, I understood that form as I learned it through them. And also, I think for a beginning writer, it's probably something, at least for me, it was a form I could comprehend and work with. And it's a lot, if there's a logic to it, it's one that I just feel really dialed into and I really understand. When I am presented in life with a trigger for a story, I see someone doing something or I overhear a bit of dialogue or something, and I start, you know, my mind starts running artistically, I immediately start thinking about it in terms of, you know, how I'm going to shape it and organize it in that sort of 6,000-word unit. Now, I'm currently working on a novel. My mm-hmm. Next book, I hope, knock on wood, will be a novel. And so I'm definitely working in a different form at the moment, which is quite different than the short story. But there's something about the tightness and the elegance of a short story. You know, you've probably heard people say, like, there's no room for a wasted word or mm-hmm. anything stray or loose, which isn't necessarily the case in a novel. It can, as Henry James referred to War and Peace, you know, the loose and baggy monster that is the novel. So that it's maybe a more plastic and expandable form. But the short story, ideally, at least as I conceive of it, should be like a good poem, should be very, very well executed and tight, and there isn't really much room for anything that hasn't really earned its place. And the kind of rigor of that, I respond well to as a writer. I like that challenge, even though mm-hmm. sometimes it's very maddening.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and we're talking about his collection of short stories, The Farther Shore, and the fact that he took that phrase from the Dhammapada. And there's one of your stories that I liked, and kind of following up on the Buddhist, you have a character who has some things to say that I think just about most of us could say, oh boy, mm-hmm. that's a monster that I've faced too. Would you read us from this story?
Terminations?
Yes, Terminations.
Yes, I'll read a couple paragraphs from a story. And just briefly, the protagonist is he's a student. He's a car salesman, and he's newly married, and he's just trying to make some changes in his life, and he's having a hard time. So I'll read a short passage from Terminations. He turns off the computer and throws himself onto the couch in the living room. Perhaps he's looking at this from the wrong end, he thinks. Perhaps this isn't a disaster, but a great opportunity. Perhaps this is the moment toward which he, in his blind ignorance, has been led. For he considers himself a selfish, scattered man, trying to juggle too many plates at once. He worries too much about money, about advancing himself, about arranging the world on his own terms. It occurs to him, as it has on more than one occasion, that he'll never be happy. He'll always want more. He'll always wish things were somehow other than they actually are. He's never, not once in his life, been able to accept what he has and simply be content with it. He recalls a time years ago when he flirted with Buddhism. He'd been dating a girl who regularly attended a Zen meditation group in town. Monks visited the group each month to give talks and offer spiritual counseling. Eventually, he requested a meeting. Not knowing any better, he treated it like a confessional. He admitted to cheating on his girlfriend. The monk's response was a lecture on karma, how, in this life, you are constantly working through the karmic consequences of this and other inherited lives. It is your koan to struggle with this, the monk said, your lust and selfishness. There's no escape from it. To acknowledge it, to admit it, these are the necessary first steps. But you must take the next step. You must work to clean up your karma, to leave this life having offered more good karma than bad.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and he's reading from one of his short stories. The collection is called The Farther Shore. And you have your character saying that he will always want more. He'll always wish things were somehow other than they actually are. He's never, not once in his life, been able to accept what he has and simply be content with it. Now, he's talking about money, and people might say, well, no, I don't worry about money. But it could be anything that we want mm-hmm. more of, that we're not content with what we have.
I'm pretty sure that's a universal sentiment, yeah. It's also, you know, a core teaching of Buddhism, for what it's worth. And this is one story where I briefly touch explicitly on those Buddhist themes, but actually the larger action of the story, I think, is about acceptance. You know, you have a couple who are facing a difficult pregnancy, a medical mm-hmm. situation, and they really have to decide how they're going to come to terms with the potential problems that they face. And I think hopefully readers will see a little bit of themselves in the particular struggle that character faces.
And some of the couples you mentioned, they want a baby, or they don't want a baby, or they want a baby so badly they're going to adopt one from China. And so it isn't necessarily money, but it's a child maybe that they want. It's something that they feel is missing in their life. They're not content with their life the way it is, and they want something more.
Right. A lot of the stories in this collection are about parenting. Mm-hmm. And that's...
One guy thinks he's terrible at it, so he's going to ask his brother,
yeah.
who must surely know more about it than he does.
Yeah, who has dubious advice for him. But a universal theme. But while I was writing these stories, I have two great kids. I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. Hello, Sophie. Hello, Peter. And that experience, I'm sure your readers or listeners will agree, is a great teaching experience. Whoever you are before you become a parent, you won't be that person very long once a kid shows up. And for me, that's been terrifically exciting on every level, and for me and for my wife. But for me as a writer, I just realized whole new territories opened up for me. And I had, characters and situations I wanted to write about. I've always admired writers like, for instance, John Updike, who, you know, when he was in his 20s and 30s, he wrote stories about being in his 20s and 30s. And when he was in his 70s, he was writing stories about being in his 70s. And it seems to me that he was so gifted about capturing, you know, the sort of essence of what his characters were going through at that stage in their life. I've always admired that. And so as I was writing these stories, I just knew I had to write about parenthood, and especially, you know, the sort of imminent arrival phase, but then also the early childhood, because knowing my own self nature, if I didn't write about it while it was happening, I'd probably forget about it. You know, there's a 7-year...
Forget what it was like.
Yeah, there's a 7-year gap between our kids. And I remember when Peter was born, you know, just like little things like, how do you change a diaper again? How do you give a baby a bath? I mean, things I'd been doing for years, but I hadn't done in 5 or 6 years. And suddenly I felt like a beginner again, and I just thought, oh my God, I better write about this now before, you know, something else comes into my brain.
So there, in your stories, there is the familiar. Those of us who live in Chico recognize these familiar places that your settings, because most of your stories, majority, do take place in Chico. But there's one that was interesting because it was so exotic. Mm-hmm. And while I was reading the stories about Chico, and I could see Bidwell Park, and when I was reading the last story, the novella, it took me back to actually Guadeloupe, mm-hmm. in the Caribbean. Because you set this story, and here's a guy who's not even married, so this is a story that's not like your others, and that is not about a husband and wife, it's not about children or parenting. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed the, I felt I was there on this tiny Caribbean island with this guy. Could you read us, we don't have time for a lot of it, but could you read a little bit of the opening of your novella?
Yes, it's called Criminals, and I'll just read the opening, few opening lines. Nestled near the tip of the Cama, that is the Eastern Caribbean, the island of Carriacou is an isolated place, small and quiet, a land of 5,000 people and 10,000 goats. I arrived in May 1990, wanting only the anonymity of a fresh start. I rented a small bungalow on the windward side with a splendid view of Bayalo, the white cascade of surf crashing against the barrier reef, the endless indigo of the open sea, broken only by a tiny speck, Petite Martinique. Day and night, the fabled trade winds blew on shore, cooling my small house and keeping down the dust and flies. Stray goats nibbled at the brush and grass surrounding my bungalow. Asses brayed in the fields. I ate mangoes and chicken roti, drank Colombian espresso in the morning, and chilled gin afternoon. I swam along shores lined with sea grape and palm trees, collecting the shells I would later document. All seemed blessed. All seemed wonderful. All would change as it must.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and he's reading from his novella, part of his collection of short stories, The Farther Shore. You are listening to a conversation with Rob Davidson from 2012. After a break, I'll be asking Rob Davidson about his latest work, Spectators, Flash Fiction. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Award-winning author Rob Davidson teaches creative writing and literature at California State University, Chico, and we heard his interview from 2012 when we talked about his collection of short stories, The Farther Shore. He now has a new collection of short fiction, Spectators, Flash Fictions. As I mentioned, his previous books included two short story collections, The Farther Shore and Field Observations. His fiction, essays, and interviews have appeared in various reviews. His honors include a Fulbright U.S. Senior Scholar Award to lecture in Taiwan in 2015-2016. Rob Davidson, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, this new fiction, you call it Flash Fictions.
Yes.
Do people wonder, Rob, what do you mean by that?
That is sometimes the question. Right. The simplest definition of a flash fiction would be a very short story. And really, that form has been around for a long time. Writers in, you know, Chekhov wrote really short pieces, anecdotes and sketches. Mark Twain wrote some yarns and humorous sketches that are really short. Some people might know Kate Chopin's story, The Story of an Hour. So in American literature, there's actually been a long tradition, but it kind of went dormant, this very short story, in the middle of the 20th century. And then around 1980, it kind of came back. The short story came back as a form, and then these really short stories came back. And for whatever reason, in the last, say, 15 or 20 years, they've become really quite popular with you know, the college crowd, the literary crowd. So flash fictions is just kind of a new name for an old form. And we really just mean very short stories. And for me, this book was really fun to write because with maybe just one or two exceptions, there's nothing over a page long in this book. These are really short stories. And after having written two books of more kind of traditional full-length short stories with plot and conflict and character, my challenge, or one of my challenges, was to be more lyric and less narrative and get away from plot and conflict and focus more on the language, more like a prose poem, I guess.
Exactly. In fact, that's what I was going to ask you, that I think some people would call it, they wrote this, would call it poetry, would call it a poem, because it takes up, like you say, sometimes less than a page, it's more like a paragraph. Yep. And when you write something lyric like that, a lot of people would say, would call it a poem.
Yeah, thank you. One of my good friends in Oregon, Henry Hughes, who teaches up at Western Oregon, he read the book and he said, this is poetry. And I took that as a great compliment. So it was an exciting challenge for me. And I knew after two books of stories more or less in the same mode, I wanted to challenge myself to do something really different. And so that's what a flash fiction is. And that's a little bit about why I chose to write these stories in that way. There's some other stuff that might be interesting for readers to know. I know we're on the radio, so you can't see the cover of the book, but it's a fellow standing in front of the Grand Canyon with a video camera. He's videotaping the Grand Canyon. Now, that's a wonderful photo by Tom Patton, who's a photographer and teaches photography at Chico State, good friend of mine. And a few years ago, I was invited to do a show at the 1078 Gallery here in Chico, where visual artists and writers were invited to collaborate. And a friend of mine, Sarah Pape, wisely put me and Tom Patton together. And boy, I just clicked with his images. I looked at these images and I thought, you know, there's a story in every one. And so initially, many of the stories that are in this book were written in response to visual art, and many of them in response to Tom Patton's work in particular. So the fancy Greek term for that is ekphrasis, right? When you're writing in response to another work of art. So that was the second challenge for me, was to look for sources of inspiration outside of my own head, if you will. And that became really exciting. So three different visual artists serve as kind of muses for the writing in this book, and then various writers who I decided to write in response to some literature. So every piece in this book is a response to some other work of art. So that was another different kind of challenge. I don't know if I was seeking to remove the burden of, you know, coming ex nihilo out of nowhere, right, with the inspiration, or I just, you know, I love visual art. I love literature. I'm always thinking about it, looking at it, reading it. And it just seemed, at a certain point, it just seemed natural to want to respond to it creatively. So that's another part of what gave shape to this book.
And this book that my guest Rob Davidson refers to is entitled Spectators. And you mentioned the cover on your book. It's bright. It's a nice color photograph that somebody here in Chico took.
Yeah, Tom Patton.
Tom Patton, and inspired you to write, and one of your poems is, in fact, entitled Spectators.
Yes.
And maybe you'd like to start by reading Spectators.
Sure. The book is in three sections, and the first section is called Spectators. The book as a whole has, I call it a governing metaphor, kind of an idea that I had in mind as I was writing it. And it's the idea of, you know, what is a spectator? Someone who's looking at something, often like a tourist destination, like the Grand Canyon. So there's something about,
like,
this
on your cover, there's
exactly.
a guy being a spectator.
Yeah, so there's something about this idea of the spectacle, that place, that location, that thing that has taken on some kind of value in our society and makes people want to go and see it. People will drive, you know, 100 miles or whatever to go see something. And so that was part of it. So this piece, Spectators, is partly in me musing about that. Behold the growing congregation, the swelling throng. We are gathered here today in confusion, clutching guidebooks and maps, rail tickets, and a street address for a cafe that someone assured us is the best place to get lunch. We are never very sure what we're looking at. You can tell us, but we won't remember. We'll take a photo anyway, shoot a video. We are restless, always moving on, never staying in one place for long. To your crumbling empires and wasted civilizations we flock. You hate us, yet obey our requests, for we have disposable income and an urge to buy. We are tourists. We are spectators. We stand before you, a roaming band and a special breed. Enchanted or distracted, aware or insensate, we exist both to observe and to be observed. For wherever we go, we present ourselves, a living spectacle, a strange circle at once sublime and absurd. We ask only that you acknowledge, as you read this, that you have joined us. Welcome.
This is Rob Davidson reading Spectators from his collection by the same name. And I noticed when I would read, go from one page to the other, I'd have to ask myself, okay, who is this? Who is the voice in this mm-hmm. story? And here is the first person, plural, we. Mm-hmm. But it's not always we. Sometimes it's third person, sometimes it's second person.
Right.
And how did you, so you're including yourself and the reader. Who are the we in this?
Yeah, it's kind of the collective, all of us idea in this particular piece. And it's the strange, to me, strange paradox. I've been a tourist. I've been that person who's traveled around the world and seen lots of things and stood out like a sore thumb. And I've also lived in places where tourists frequently come. And then you kind of have that insider's, you know, sometimes it's a resentment or just, you know, what are they doing here? So I've been on both sides of that. I'm sure a lot of listeners have. And that's an interesting tension to me. And it also, you know, raises that question, like, what is it when a tourist visits a place, do they even know why they're there? Maybe you just always heard, oh, you're supposed to go to Notre Dame Cathedral, but you don't necessarily know the first thing about it. So you just go and look and, okay, I've seen it, but what does it mean to you, you know? One of my favorite contemporary American novels is White Noise by Don DeLillo. And there's a chapter in that novel called The Most Photographed Barn in America. And in the novel, these two college professors drive out and they're snapping photos of a barn, just an ordinary barn in the Midwest. And there's hundreds of people. And one of the professors says, I don't get it. This isn't really even a particularly beautiful barn. Why is it such a big deal? And the other guy says, you don't get it. It's not the barn. It's the idea of the barn. That's why the people are here, so they can just say, I was there, right? So it's that, I love that idea of the spectacle. I think, I'm sure listeners would agree, we live in the age of the spectacle, right? If it's a media spectacle, a TV spectacle, a political spectacle, there's always something going on that kind of excites us, and there's a collective force there. We like to be part of a crowd. We like to be in, you know? And even if we don't always understand what we're part of, there's something deeply alluring about that in our media-saturated culture. So that's part of what that piece is about, you know, that not knowingness, if you will, that blindness that sometimes leads a group on. And I'm implicating the voice of that piece is implicated in it, saying I'm not separate from that. I'm part of it too, because I think that's true.
Well, if you'll permit me, I have a little bit different point of view in that I've spent quite a few years being a pilgrim. I mean, literally, I would go over and walk the medieval pilgrimage trail across Spain mm-hmm. and then across France. Mm-hmm. And I always made the distinction between pilgrims and tourists.
Sure.
And I identified as a pilgrim. I'm actually a certified pilgrim. I've got a certificate in Latin.
Okay, that's
great.
That
I'm a pilgrim. And I never felt I was a tourist.
Yeah.
But when I read your fiction, Charlemagne at Point Zero, mm-hmm. it took me back 2 years ago when I'd been to Notre Dame Cathedral, Notre Dame, years ago, but I went out actually to see something else, and the line was so long to see this other attraction, I thought, now I'll give up the stained glass windows and I'll just go to Notre Dame. And when I got there, of course, the lines were so long that I thought, mm-hmm. well, I've walked this far, I'll just kind of linger here and see what's here. So when I started reading your Cathedral of Notre Dame of Paris, I knew exactly what you were talking about.
Good.
And I had looked at this equestrian statue of Charlemagne, mm-hmm. and of course there's a metal plate in the ground yep. saying this is Point Zero.
Right.
And I just thoroughly enjoyed this, but I wondered, that's probably pretty mysterious to people who have not, or even people who have been there, if they just went straight into the cathedral.
Yeah.
And didn't hang around what's there in front of the church.
Yeah, no, thank you, Nancy. I think you've just articulated a really important difference. A pilgrim or someone who's in a place for a particular reason and knows why he or she is there, has a mission, a goal, is very different from a tourist, as I'm conceiving it. And admittedly, I'm being a little snarky, right, in parts of this book. And again, I want listeners to know I've been the tourist, so I'm not saying I'm not one of them. But in fact, the theme of pilgrimage is important to parts of this first section. The very first mm-hmm. piece is called Clean Pilgrim.
Yes.
And it's that idea of the metaphor, really, more of someone who's seeking a purpose, someone who's seeking meaning for a journey, both literal and figurative, and that in contrast to these tourists and spectators. Other pieces, there's a piece called Women Going Opposite Ways, and that's about losing your direction or not having the same agreement with someone else about what something means. But right, Charlemagne at point zero is, some of the pieces have subtitles, so I kind of ground the reader in a location, and that one is the Cathédrale de Notre-Dame de Paris. And maybe I'll just read that.
Yes, please do.
And then we can talk about it. But yeah, I'm glad you've picked up on the details and know exactly what I'm referencing. Charlemagne, Pater Europae, sits astride his steed, noble servants at his side. He raises his scepter, forever unifying and defining a continent, forever advancing his Christian cause, forever brutalizing the infidels and the quarrelsome. Every story has its point zero, genesis of empire, point from which all measurements are drawn. Fear not, O king, your story survives. The very republic in which we stand is a byproduct of your gesture. Not that it looks like it. In your presence, people mill about, strolling here and there, checking messages and consulting maps. Some are hungry, some are horny, some don't know what time it is. This is the true and final consequence of empire, to be lost in the quotidian, the everyday, the banal. Forever shall you sit, Charlemagne, tarnished and ignored. Yes, you rule us fine.
This is fiction writer Rob Davidson reading from the first section of his new collection, Spectators. And this was Charlemagne at point zero, Cathédrale de Notre-Dame de Paris.
Yes.
As you said. And most of the time, writers are using metaphor, but this is quite literally when you say point zero, a point from which all measurements are drawn, that's quite literal.
Yeah, there, like you said, there's a dial or a compass in the plaza there out front of the cathedral, and it literally is point zero for all the maps in France, which I've always found so fascinating, right? The idea of Paris, right? We think of Paris, don't we, as this center of culture. And literally, they made it that way in terms of how they limbed out and mapped their...
designated, this is point zero.
Yeah, so to me, that just speaks volumes, right? And the image that I'm responding to in this piece is a picture of this plaza filled with people on their smartphones, kind of staring off.
I was one of those people wandering around thinking, I'm not going to wait in line to go into the cathedral. I'm just going to wander around here, just like you described. You say, in your presence, people mill about, strolling here and there. And you hear all sorts of languages, people from all countries.
Oh, great mix. Yeah,
great mix. Checking messages, consulting maps.
And that's so fascinating because then there's this, of course, this statue of Charlemagne, this incredibly important figure of Western civilization. And, you know, a good sculpture tells a story, a good statue tells a story, and that iconography is very famous. A lot of people probably know it. You can Google search it. You know, there's a story right there, this kind of proud emperor on his horse and his minions below him and so on. And I just love that contrast of this kind of high French culture contrasted with a plaza filled with people from all around the world who either don't know or don't care, you know, or at least that's my supposition as the writer in the piece. And also this idea of, you know, what the French Republic and this whole idea of empire. We live in an age where a lot of us question those narratives now, and we aren't so quick to assume that Western culture is any better than any other culture or that the French have anything superior to any other. You know, some of the things that maybe like I grew up just assuming I'd heard that was right. You know, Europe is better. You know, it's like, why? Why is it better? How is it better? You know, so this piece is kind of gently pushing back at that a little bit, kind of mocking Charlemagne, actually.
Yeah, because he is this icon of virtue and he's a hero. And yet you say, forever advancing his Christian cause, forever brutalizing the infidels and quarrelsome. I mean, these heroes, the Cid And Charlemagne, they were brutal.
Yeah, of course. If you study the history in any sort of critical context, that quickly becomes apparent. And that's when I'm glad to be, you know, in the era that I'm in, because, you know, when I was a kid, for example, Columbus was a hero, right? Unquestioned. We have streets and cities named after him. But around the time of his 500th birthday, right, there was a great reassessment. And for a lot of people now, he's just sort of creep number one. So I think it's healthy. I'm not saying, you know, Charlemagne was all bad or anything like that, but just that this piece tries to put his legacy in a critical context and point things out like that, that he was quite brutal to the infidels. He wanted everyone to convert to Christianity, and if they didn't, he was incredibly violent.
Well, you have a conversation in your book that I feel like an eavesdropper. There's one where this wife is, I mean, this is how, in my imagination, mm-hmm. it's this wife who's reproaching her husband, and the title is Woman Annoyed. Mm-hmm. And I always would look at the title, read the fiction, and then go back and look at the title again, because you had so much information, you ignored the title at your peril as a reader. But I thought, gosh, I'm eavesdropping on this woman berates her husband. And I thought, ooh, golly.
Yeah,
because there's humor in your stories. But,
oh, I'm glad to hear that, because that's definitely a big part of what I was going for. Yeah, that piece, Woman Annoyed, it is kind of a monologue. So it is like you're eavesdropping, and the person she's addressing, her partner or husband, doesn't get to say anything back. And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, another thing I love about travel is that you sometimes you overhear things. You see things. I mean, you don't have to be traveling. That can happen in downtown Chico. But somehow when you're in a crowded space, especially, and travel can be stressful, so tempers flare, and you'll see things and hear things. People will just say the most biting things to each other, maybe because they know they're surrounded by strangers and no one else knows. So this piece was, in my mind, it was almost like you were eavesdropping or inside her head or something like that. I can read that piece.
Sure.
Woman Annoyed. Not that one again. Don't you know it never works? I don't know why you keep asking. You're so relentless. You're so obsessed. You think everyone will come around to see things your way. But you're wrong. I know what you're on about. I see through your lies, your dissembling. Because you're so obvious. Because it's always the same thing. You only want one thing. Though you ask a thousand ways. Let me tell you something. You're not growing stronger. You're growing weaker, more childlike. That's what you are now. You're a child with your wants and needs, your desire to have things your way. You want someone to cater to you. You want someone to clean up your mess. You want someone to tell you it's all right. But it's not all right. Not with me, it's not. I know you. I'm not stupid. And I'm not having it. Not for one single second.
This is a short fiction, Woman Annoyed, by author Rob Davidson. So that's one you feel like, this is a little... Maybe,
it's a little because, close and personal.
Yeah, because you say in there that these are people like we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see ourselves in this. Now, sometimes I did not see myself, like when you said a woman wants to look good when she's dead. And I thought, well, now, Rob, that's stretching it. I don't care how eloquent I did.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I can understand how not every reader. That particular line I stole from somebody, a friend of mine, who said that to me once. And I just carried it around in my head. I don't know if it's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting observation.
And then another time, like when you're drowning, you want to make sure you look good when you're drowning. But, Rob, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at The Mistake of Waiting. Mm-hmm. In your collection.
Right. That piece is, well, I'll read it and then maybe we can talk about it. The Mistake of Waiting. The mistake most commonly made by those asked to wait is to focus on that which has not yet happened. The anticipation of action, the expectation of the event, the anxiety of delay. These obscure the truth of waiting, which is a radiant stasis. He knows what he's waiting for. He knows it's coming, sooner or later. He just doesn't know exactly when, or how, or what happens next. These are the things he thinks about, but that is precisely his mistake. To focus on a mysterious future, a thing at once terrifying and banal, and not on the wait itself. He will be waiting for a good while yet. He ought to turn his attention accordingly. There is only the waiting itself, for which there is no wait. The truth of waiting is that one should endeavor to do only that, without expectation or desire. Accept this bright parade of moments. It is your story now.
This is a fiction entitled The Mistake of Waiting by Rob Davidson. And I like that because there's truth there.
Yeah, good. That is what I'm aiming at. The larger, kind of philosophical level there, probably not too hard for listeners to figure out. It's kind of a meditation on death and mortality. And, there's an old saying that, death is that which gives meaning to life. Mm-hmm. So there's some of that there. But also with this idea of the spectators and tourism and so forth, turns out you do a lot of waiting.
When
you're a tourist. You get in lines and queues.
Oh, especially airports. Gosh.
And people tend to think of that as wasted time, right? They want to be at the thing, right? And this piece sort of cheekily says, it's a mistake to think that's wasted time. That's all you've got is this moment. Kind of a Buddhist idea, right? You got moment by moment. So just, seize the moment, make the most of whatever it is you're doing right now kind of idea.
Well, I enjoyed a quote by Troy Jollimore, one of my favorite poets.
Yeah.
And he says that this book that you have put together, the book goes straight for the metaphysical jugular, offering vividly sketched characters in whom you will surely recognize yourself and the world you and I walk through on a daily basis, dumbfounded and amazed and taking in the sights.
Yeah, isn't that great? Thanks, Troy, for that that blurb. I really was glad that he was able to do that and had some nice things to say about the book.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, too, I could see, like with this one, this fact of waiting, you want to focus on what hasn't happened yet.
Right, yeah, that there is a kind of metaphysical or philosophical dimension to some of these pieces. And that was part of what I was looking for. I admire writers who can artfully bring forward those kinds of deeper questions without necessarily starting to sound like a sermon or something like that. So I definitely was pushing in pieces like The Mistake of Waiting to use the opportunity of writing a very short story as a kind of opportunity to pose a question. Writers who are really good at that, in my mind, are writers like Borges or Franz Kafka, or even more contemporary writers like David Foster Wallace. They were really good at kind of capturing your imagination that way, but also doing whatever it is you want art to do, expand your horizons.
Yeah, and because a lot of times you conclude with kind of a moral or kind of a thought to get the reader thinking.
Yeah, a little hook.
Yes, there's a good word for it.
Yeah, to intrigue the reader, hopefully. Right, yes, definitely.
For example, one entitled Today's Lesson, your concluding statement is, disappointment has its benefits, nudging us toward joy. Rob, in the back of your new book, Spectators, is a piece that is unlike the preceding flash fiction in that book. You call it author's note. Would you please read that?
My name is Rob. I work for Davidson. It is I, Rob, who has a wife and two children. I mow my lawn, vote my conscience, wave to the neighbors. If there are a few hard-earned dollars in my bank account, it is because I work. I spend roughly 400 hours each year in a classroom or a lecture hall, standing before students and colleagues talking about what he, Davidson, does. I speak his language, one of drafting and revision, artifice and craft, form and content. I do this willingly, lovingly, without an ounce of resentment, all for Davidson. He couldn't live for 5 minutes without me, his Rob. Davidson lives just 2 hours a day, longer in summer or during winter breaks. He might resurrect himself for 4 or 5 hours a day then, but during the school year, when I have my son's soiled diaper in one hand and a student essay in the other and the phone is ringing, he's damn lucky to get his 2 hours, believe me. He's greedy, you see. If you overlook him, ignore him, try to forget about him, he'll be right there, at my throat, scratching and pleading and making his incessant, ultimately unstoppable demands. And so I rearrange my life to accommodate him. I make and cancel plans. I schedule my trips to the grocery, to the playground, to the post office around his 2 hours. I teach my classes and earn my paycheck so that he, Davidson, may live. Occasionally, I am invited to read his work before some group or other. A few people might line up afterwards to buy a book and ask questions. They want, of course, to speak with him. I cannot muster the courage to tell them he didn't come. He's never, ever available for this kind of public appearance. No one can ever see him or visit or ask him a question. He shall never respond. He lives, you see, a strange kind of existence, hidden away in that room of his, tapping away on his keyboard, constructing his city of language. No, not city. Sorry, Davidson, but you haven't yet written your city. Not even a town. A village, perhaps. A hamlet. It is there he lives, issuing all too infrequently his latest missive, a small bundle of white paper with neat black ink, printing, words. He's most proud of that. Only that, I suppose, for that is all he is. A wordsmith, a kind of artisan or craftsman. That is the one thing, the only thing he does. Me? I'm not exactly proud of him. Grateful, in a way. Oddly enough, it is what he does that allows me to do what I do. Teaching allows me to pay the mortgage on my house, to buy my kids a new shirt or a book, to take the wife out for dinner and a movie now and again. Teaching allows me to live my ordinary quiet life on my ordinary quiet cul-de-sac in this ordinary quiet town. It's only when someone has taken the time and trouble to read his books and then makes the connection between him and me, Davidson and his Rob, that the trouble begins. It is there, you see, on the page, that the mistake occurs. We are constantly mistaken for each other. His readers, you happy few, especially those who know me, Rob, sometimes mistakenly think that they see me on the page in some incident or action, some image or quip of dialogue, but they are never correct. Davidson has fooled them because he's a thief. He steals unmercifully, without conscience or compunction, from those closest to him and from the world at large. Mostly he steals from me, from my memory. You'd think I would resent that. I probably should, for when he steals a memory, he doesn't simply take it verbatim. Invariably, he changes it, paints the red barn blue. He makes me taller, smarter, quicker than I am, or dumber, uglier, Republican. Or he puts me in Phoenix when I was really in Houston. He makes me older or younger, changes my name, my sex, my occupation. As I say, I should probably resent that, but I do not. Far from it. For it is precisely then, when he's changed me so much that I cannot recognize myself, that I see myself most clearly. And I love him for that. That is why I work unstintingly for him, making sure that his 2 hours are given freely and are taken without interruption or distraction. It is not that Davidson cannot exist without his Rob, but that there is no Rob without his Davidson. There is no reality that is not finally mediated by an elaborate fantasy.
I wish we had time to read more of these short fictions, Rob, but we'll leave that to the readers to contemplate. It's been a joy talking to you
today. Thank you, Nancy. I really appreciate coming in.
The book is Spectators, Flash Fictions by Rob Davidson. You can hear this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.